There's a couple of things I would like to add to where we were. Let me review a moment, if you wouldn't mind. I have 4 points that I wanted to stress about disciple making. The first one was how disciples are chosen. And I tried to work through that a bit and used Peter as an example in terms of Jesus chose them rather than they chose Jesus. Sorry, just give me a second. I've got a, for some reason my index didn't cycle through. There we go. Okay, we started here, and I noted that Jesus chose disciples, I think unlikely, probably younger than what we're used to. And then we noted that the disciples were selected by Jesus rather than that they chose him, because he wanted them to know that he had confidence in them. I think that's such a huge thing. Now, there's a couple of other things I wanted to pick up beyond that. The next one is, the disciples that he chose live with the rabbi. That's absolutely essential to the process, because it's not the intellectual exchange of data that creates the disciple. It's the experiential practice of becoming like someone. It's internship. It's mentoring. And that's the place at which I think our modern disciple-making practice in our churches breaks down. Because we spend very little time with a rabbi. A, we pick a senior pastor and we ask him or her to rabbi 1,000 people. Think about it. If Jesus had 12, the greatest rabbi who ever lived, and one of those didn't make it, what on earth gives us the idea that a pastor could possibly rabbi 100 or 200 or 1,000? We've created a rabbi thing where it's about listening to a pastor be a dynamic preacher, and that's discipleship. Now, that's a wonderful thing if you have a pastor who's a dynamic preacher. But that's not discipleship. Discipleship is learning to become like. And preaching may enable that, but it's got to be being mentored in the world by someone whose walk with God you desire to imitate. And with all my heart, I ask you to find a rabbi, especially those of you who are under 20 or under 25. Find someone whose walk with God you deeply admire and wish to imitate. Not personality, not... And spend time with that person. Go to them and say, may I follow you? May I spend an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, a half a day, a week, learning to watch you walk with God. Now, I get these looks from people when I do that, like, I have a life. How badly do you want to be a disciple? Notice Jesus came. Okay, he fed 5,000. Okay, he preached to big crowds. His whole focus was 12 disciples. He came because he knew if he had the right group of 12, 7 women end up with him, so you could say 19. One fails out, Judas, so he ends up with 18. And you're here today because of those 18. 2,000 years later, it's still working. The second thing is, it strikes me, how much time do you and I spend with Jesus? I remember being in a group, in a class, where the person that I think of as the greatest authority on Jesus in the world, I won't mention his, well, it's David Flusser from the Hebrew University. He's Jewish. He does not see Jesus as Messiah. But I never met anybody who knew more what Jesus was claiming to believe and to teach than he does. And he was discussing discipleship. And he was talking about how Christians use the word disciple. And his comment went something like this. Any Christian who calls himself or herself a disciple that doesn't read the four Gospels at least once a week is a liar. You couldn't possibly know Jesus well enough to be like him if you didn't read the four Gospels once a week. Now, set that up as the bar. When's the last time you read the four Gospels? Ever? I'll give you a challenge. 1st of April, read Matthew. 1st of May, Mark. June, Luke. July, John. Do that 3 years. You'll read each gospel 9 times. You won't be the same person three years from today. No one can spend that much time with Jesus and not be changed. I don't know how you and I ever think we could be a disciple and not do something like that. Now, if I had my way, what I challenge my high school kids with, their challenge is commit to God that if He gives you the biblical 4 score and 10, that you will memorize the 4 Gospels. I'm not kidding. If you would make a serious effort to become a student of the Jesus books, that would be the first step to discipleship. Big time. Now, people say, well, what about the rest of the Bible? Oh, you got to read that too. Yeah, but I have a job. And how badly do you want to be a disciple? I encourage you in that. Seriously, try it for 3 years. I mean, not because I said it. What have you got to lose? It's the Bible, right? Okay, so they live with the rabbi. And then, as they live with him, they become like him. Now that I want to spend a few moments on, and I want to point out a couple of things. That is 6 weeks in class, so I'm going to try and do it in 20 minutes. So pray for me. I think it is essential to understand that our goal as Christians, as disciples, is to want to become like Jesus in his walk with God. No, we're not sinless. No, we're certainly not divine. No, we aren't the Messiah. But in our walk with God, to want to be like Jesus, that people will see in us Jesus-like qualities. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think it means a lot of things, but I singled out 3 of them. The model for the Jewish world, for rabbi-disciple, is Elijah-Elisha. Elijah is thought of as the first great rabbi because he followed God, he was passionate for God, and then at the end of his life, he finds meaning in life by having one disciple, Elisha. And even though you could say Moses had Joshua, in most of the Jewish literature, it's Elijah, Elisha that models what a rabbi is. Now, come with me. This is the This is the actual Mount Carmel. Okay, taken from the Jezreel Valley. I'm standing right here on the bank of the Kishon River. This peak is the highest peak by about 30 feet of a mountain that's about 14 miles long and about 4 miles wide. Hence, it's the logical place where Elijah had the contest with the Baal prophets. And there's some good arguments, that's not my point today to teach that whole lesson, but there's some good arguments that it probably was there, although my story won't change if it wasn't. Now here's the story. Elijah climbed up that mountain early in the morning. Now, Pastor Brian has done this. A couple of others of you have done this. It's a pretty good climb. I think we came down though, didn't we? Doesn't matter. Here's the road. See it? It's about a 2,400-foot altitude change, and from the valley, about 3 miles to make that 2,200 feet. So it's a pretty good climb. So Elijah climbs up there first thing in the morning, harasses the Baal prophets all day long. At 3 o'clock, or just before, he builds an altar. Now the altar is made of 12 stones, but it's big enough to hold a bull. So I think those 12 stones are fairly good size. So it must have taken quite an effort to build such an altar by himself. Then he slaughtered and butchered a bull. Now I would guess there's some farm... I remember Grandpa would get up on a Saturday morning, lead a cow into the yard behind the house where there was a big tree with a limb. Grandma and Mom had come out with all the big kettles. Grandpa'd shoot the thing. They'd hang it in the tree. And it would work all day long to butcher one animal. Five, six, seven people. Elijah does it by himself. Catches a bull, kills a bull, slaughters the thing, and then at least cuts it up enough to get it on that altar. Then he prays his heart out. Lightning comes down from heaven and hits dead center on the altar. Then, after 3 o'clock, Elijah says, catch the prophets, and they lead them down 2,400 feet at the closest 4.5 miles. Anywhere else on that mountain, it's going to be farther to the bank of the Kishon River right behind where I'm taking this picture from. 2,400 feet, 4.5 miles. Then he climbs back up 2,400 feet, 4.5 miles. And he prays his heart out for rain. Then he climbs all the way back down 2,400 feet, 4.5 miles. He says to Ahab, get in your chariot, it's going to rain. And now this guy girds up his bathrobe, and he runs ahead of the chariot, minimum 18.5 miles. Almost a marathon. All in one day. Tell me the last time you put that effort into your walk with God. So the Jews looked at this guy. Now that's what a rabbi is. Fire. They have a passion that burns within them. There's nothing they won't do to walk with God. Up the mountain. Pray all day. Build an altar. Slaughter a bull. Down the mountain. Up the mountain. Down the mountain. And then run a marathon. And not think twice. That's Elijah. That's the kind of fire you expect to have when you walk with God. Now what do you think it meant that people keep mistaking Jesus for Elijah? It is impossible in that setting that anybody would have had any inkling that Jesus was Elijah if he's this soft-spoken, unemotional, dispassionate person. Now, I'm not saying he's loud and jumpy like me. That's personality. But it was clear that in that man, there was a fire burning. It must have shown in his eyes. It must have shown in his walk. It must have shown in every single thing that he did, that he was on fire for his Heavenly Father. And I think that's part of what it's like to be like Jesus. I get questions from high school kids all the time. Why aren't adults more excited about God? Now, one of two things is true. Either we aren't, or we've spent so many hours practicing the Christian way to show our fire. Praise the Lord. And what I'm encouraging you to pray for and to seek is to spend time with people who have passion for God, but then to have the guts to let yours out. See, I know, I sat at a dinner table with a really neat group of people. They're excited about a lot of things. I got some good questions back and forth. I'm with you for 5 minutes, and I know what in life you're passionate about. You can't hide it. Why is it we don't see that in one another when it comes to Jesus? Wouldn't it be cool if somebody said, wow, you remind me of Elijah? And it was in that setting. Now, again, please don't think I'm suggesting you have to have a personality like me. My wife says one is more than enough. So you have to know my wife. My wife is this quiet, some of you know my wife, this quiet, gentle, always calm, never ruffled. But she's got a fire in her too, in her own way. And boy, can you see that 10 miles away. But She's got to be a saint to live with me. Wouldn't you agree? To imagine living in the same house with me. Amen. Thank you. I'll tell you a story. My wife and I have decided we are not going to imbibe alcohol. And it's not because we think it's sinful, but because I work with high school kids. And that's a huge struggle for high school kids, at least where we are. I would assume it is for you too. It's a huge struggle for adults, but it's a huge struggle for high school kids. So we've just said, look, we won't do it. Not to tell them they shouldn't, but just as our way of saying it's a sacrifice I will make out of respect for the struggle you have. Long story. Anyway, 3 weeks ago, it was my brother and sister-in-law's 25th anniversary. So we threw a party for them. Well, my brother is a, what do you call it, oinophile? No, what's a wine lover? A wino? No, my brother isn't a wino. He just said my brother's a wino. A connoisseur of wine. So we had this long discussion. He knew, they knew we don't drink. So I said to Esther, I said, look, we didn't quit drinking because we thought it was sinful. So let's just have some bottles of good wine. We don't have to drink it, but it's not wrong to have on the table. She wasn't very happy with that. She thought that looked like cheating, but she finally agreed. So she went out to get it. So she's got 3 bottles of wine in a bag on the seat of the car. She picked up her sister, and on the way home, her sister's looking in this bag. Now, her sister knows all about this. So, of course, Esther's totally embarrassed in front of her sister. So, as she's looking in that bag, Esther says to her sister, yeah, I got it for my husband. Anyway, her sister says, good trade. I think we have to make a decision that part of making disciples is having the guts to let our passion out. And I decided in Israel, in this setting, watching Jewish people who would get up and dance because they loved God so much they didn't know what else to do, that I was going to stop hiding it. And you may think I'm a nudnik. I think students sometimes think I'm a nudnik. And maybe I am a nudnik. But to be honest, it's what I feel inside, and I am not going to hide it, because I want to be like him. That's first. Second, I think being like him has another dimension, too. Come with me, and we'll make a long story short. This is the Jordan River. Disappointment to most. You wouldn't call it river. You'd say crick, or do you say creek in this area? I don't know what you say, but that's about as big as it gets. Yeah, you can see by the bank that it gets a little deeper than that at flood season, but it's not what I had imagined. But it is the Jordan. Now, in the Jewish world, water has double meaning. On the one hand, it can be the cleansing, life-giving gift of God, like you see outside here. On the other hand, water is that dangerous, churning, deathly stuff in the canyons in the desert. Therefore, to them, churning, moving water like this is a symbol of chaos. It's the opposite of God. It's that destructive flood in the desert. It's that deadly lack of order, lack of meaning, everything that's opposite of the organization, the goodness, the purpose of God. And they noticed that that's how the world began. The world began with churning water. Now the earth was formless and empty, and the Spirit of God hovered over the water. Formless and empty, like this, just totally meaningless, absolutely without purpose. Fortunately, as the Spirit of God hovered, God spoke. And when he spoke to the water, they would say, out of that chaos came order. Land, plants, planets, animals, people, all working magnificently together the exact opposite of this. God turned it over to His two servants, Adam and Eve, and the next thing was temptation. And they decided they didn't want to do it God's way, to make a long story short, and their sin turned this beautiful order back into chaos. And marriages didn't work. And their oldest son killed his brother. And chaos descended onto God's beautiful world. Now the Bible, from a Jewish point of view, has a word for someone whose life is in chaos. Anybody know what it is? The poor. We take the poor to mean people without money. Well, that's a kind of chaos if you don't have enough money to eat. The poor in the Bible, I think, refers to people whose lives are in chaos. So somebody with a lot of money could be called poor if your life is in chaos. In the book of Isaiah, the prediction is made that someday, like back here, the Spirit of God will hover over the chaos. And you know what will happen? The blind will see. The lame will walk. The leper will be healed. The deaf will hear. The dead will be raised. And the poor will hear the good news. In other words, someday, God's Spirit will hover, and the poor, in whatever form, will be brought out of chaos back to order. That's what the rabbis taught. Are you with me? Now, I think that that's what lies behind Jesus' baptism. One of the things that lies behind Jesus' baptism. Because I think Jesus came down to the river to do mikvah. He didn't need forgiveness. He was not a sinner. He could have used it to dedicate his head, heart, hands, and feet to God, and I think that's probably part of it. I think he came down there to make another statement. I think Jesus came down to the river, hear me out, and when he got there, came down off the bank, and into the water he went, and stood right in the middle of the chaos. This man in whom there was no chaos. Fortunately, the Spirit of God hovered. The voice spoke, "This is my son." And up out of the water, he came. And what happened? The blind began to see. And the lame began to walk. And lepers, some of them at least, were healed. And deaf could hear for the first time, some. And dead were raised. And a little bit of chaos is restored. What supports that interpretation is not only that that's exactly how the Jew viewed the coming of Messiah, but what supports it is, what's the next event that happens? Temptation. Just like the first time, temptation. The second time, temptation. Now, here's my point. Two thoughts. One, aren't you glad Jesus didn't stand on the bank? He could have stood up there and said, "Hey, you folks in chaos, hang in there. I see your pain. Sooner or later." You know what this man without chaos did? He joined us in all the same pain and brokenness that we have. Later, his friend, cousin, John, struggles. Because if Jesus is the one to undo chaos, why am I in Herod's jail? Nobody gets out of Herod's jail. So John picks two of his disciples, helps us to appreciate John was a rabbi also, and sends them to Jesus with this question: are you the coming one, or should we look for another? Jesus turns to those two and he says to them, go tell your rabbi what? The blind see, the lame walk, lepers are healed, deaf hear, dead are raised, and the poor hear the good news. It's happening! But then, my point for you. Jesus, as the disciples go off to tell John, there's a real sad note in it, but maybe we'll have time to get to that later this afternoon. Jesus turns to the crowd, you, me, and he says this, I tell you the truth, no one born of a woman is greater than John. But the least one of you in my kingdom is greater than John. Huh? Interpretation. And I want to say that because I want you to understand that. But from a Jewish point of view, what Jesus just said is this. Based on Jesus' teaching, John got to see that the one who came to undo chaos is here. There he is. You get to bring it. Your mission is to walk into this world of chaos and to bring just a little bit of new order to broken people. And every time you go to a funeral home, every time you spend 10 minutes with someone in a nursing home that hasn't had a visitor, every time you eat lunch with somebody in the cafeteria that no one ever eats with, every time you wipe away one tear, every time, you give somebody just a taste of the sweetness of the new order. But you cannot, I cannot stand on the bank. It's so easy to say, I'll send you a check. We'll hire a food coordinator. I'll make a donation to Habitat. Now, those are good things. But if I'm like Jesus, I'm down there in the chaos with chaotic people. I love to take people to the Jordan because we walk in and stand there and the water tears at you and many a tear has added its water to the volume of that river because all of a sudden you feel the chaos you're in every single day. You feel it tear at you. And that feeling of someone coming and standing next to you and holding out a hand and saying, here, and two of you standing together, the water is every bit as violent. But somehow, you stand better with two than with one. And I think part of what it means to be like Jesus isn't just righteousness, holiness, obedience, passion. I think it's a willingness to look for those places where we enter the world of brokenness. And honestly, I think that's an area some Christians do very well at, and I think others of us are very poor. We would much rather send a donation. Let me show you a moment in my life here. This is a little off the subject, but since I'm the guy with the microphone, of course there's somebody back there running the volume, but let me just show you something once. How God teaches me. I've had a struggle with this one, big time, in the last 3 months. And pray for me. I'm at a crossroads in my life, my ministry. I love what I do, as you know, this morning. But I had a troubling moment. About 2 years ago, I got an invitation to go to India to teach in a seminary in a place called Chennai. It's an evangelical Christian group, and they wanted to look at the Eastern discipleship thing. So I did a lot of what I'm doing here and other things, too, right here in India. So I went there in January. Well, just before I got there, as you know, they had tsunami. So we walked right into the middle of that. Now, I'm not trying to suggest I can tell you anything you don't already know, but I'll tell you something from the bottom of my heart. Until you've stood there, it is impossible to imagine what that tsunami must have been. I mean, you see those trees in the background. The second wave was double the height of those trees, and it was more than 20 kilometers wide. So we strolled on the beach that first afternoon, and I first said to my wife, well, it doesn't really look like much. There's just a lot of junk laying around. And then it dawned on me, that was a village. That was an entire village of 500 people. There are 140 have survived. And so we walked among those places. I mean, those were houses. Those were lives. Those were people. It was just, I was just in shock. I had never, ever faced anything like that. And then I met this boy. His name is Vedri. He's 15. That was his home. Five brothers and sisters, mom and dad, uncles and aunts and cousins that lived with him. His life today consists of a plastic pail, a cooking pot, and that blue tarp. Everything else is gone. His parents, his grandparents, his uncles, his aunts, his cousins. There is nothing left of his world but those things. And I stood there with this kid. I didn't know what to do. They told us don't take money down to the beach, not because of pickpockets, but because if you once start handing out money, they are not getting anything from the government at this point. There's going to be a riot. I had 300 rupees, $8. So I thought to myself, riot or not, I'm going to give that $8 to this kid. The government was selling rice for two rupees a cup. So I had 800 rupees. So I figured that's 400 cups of rice. If my math is accurate. I'm sorry. My math is way off. I had 300 rupees, about $8. Rice is 2 rupees a cup. So that was 150 cups of rice. I thought, he'll eat for a while. So I gave him the money. You know what he did? He went to the government truck and he bought all the rice he could buy and gave it away. Went from person to person to person and gave them rice. And I cried because I had given him the money thinking like I think. I got 300 rupees. I'm going to eat for a while. He had met a friend that touched me too, the boy on the left, who had walked from about 20 kilometers away. He had lost everything as well in another fishing village. Everything the boy on the left has in the world is in that basket. Now you tell me, should I be here today? I cannot tell you the personal trauma I wrestled with and still do. I think Jesus would have stayed on the beach. I don't know. I'm laying my soul out before you. I'm glad I'm here. It's way too easy for me to enter his chaos, give him 300 rupees, $8, and then fly back here. But my wife taught me something. Because on the way home, We went, there was another one that, oh man, I don't want to hear the whole tsunami story. But on the way home, I had to speak on the weekend. I had a funny thing. I'll tell you this story too, although the whole story isn't so funny. But I went to Calcutta, and they asked me to speak in the oldest, largest Anglican church in Calcutta. It's called St. Paul's. It was a real honor, I guess. I don't know anything about Anglicans, to be honest, but everybody seemed to think, oh my goodness, you're speaking at St. Paul's. Happened to be that the pastor of St. Paul's had gone to the seminary where I spoke. So I spoke there, and I asked them to sing some songs. Well, they sang like Anglicans. And I'm not knocking Anglicans, but it's like, do you guys believe this stuff or not? Sing! And the last song, I cannot think of the name of it. The last song I asked them to sing, now you're going to have to pardon me because I'm frustrated. I cannot think of the name of the last song. Oh, it's a song you know so well. Give me just a second. What a stupid nudnik. I cannot believe that I cannot think of the name of the song. And if I don't find it, I'm really going to be frustrated. Yeah. Ah, come on. It's Holy, Holy, Holy. Just I know. Go ahead and laugh at me. That's all right. It was quite an experience. It honestly was. Okay, I'm going to, just a second. You got a minute? Okay, I'm going to put two pictures up here so you can see it. My students call this an RVL. You're pulling an RVL. Total loss of any mental sanity. Okay, there we go. Now let me show you. First I'll show you the... I just dropped the pictures in over top. Okay. Ah, you can hardly see it. I am really sorry. Okay, here we are. Just about there. Give me a second. Okay. There we go. That's the church. After church. Anyway, it was about half full. And it was cool. It went very well. The last song I asked them to sing was Holy, Holy, Holy. Well, this congregation raised the roof. I hadn't heard singing like that, I mean, even in evangelical churches in this country. It was unbelievable. So after the service, I went to the bishop and I said to him, what was the deal with the last song? And he said, you don't know? And I said, no. And he said, come here once. Let me show you something. So he led me into the next, into a large narthex room to this statue. He said, you know who that is? I said, no. He said, that's the guy who wrote that song. He wrote that song sitting right over here one Sunday morning before church. He didn't like the song that he had to close the service with. So he sat, holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, song shall rise to thee. He wrote that song right here. I was like, you have got to be kidding. I felt really, and I don't know if it was worth all that time. Anyway, at the end of that time, I was going to show you that God taught me something. In Calcutta, I went that afternoon with my wife, actually late morning, went with my wife here. That's Mother Teresa's place. And it's the home for the sick and dying. In Calcutta, people who are dying, they lay them on the sidewalk and leave them die, and then the garbage trucks pick them up in the morning. So Mother Teresa came up with a ministry where they have an old truck that rides around Calcutta picking up dying people. And they bring him here and help them to die with dignity. So I walked in that first floor. The women are on the second floor, so I couldn't go up there. But I walked in on that first floor. There were 109 men lying on the floor dying. 72 of them would be dead by the time I left at 5 o'clock. AIDS, typhoid, you name it. And there they lay, on a mat, on the floor. A few volunteers. I said to Esther, I cannot be here. I either have to leave or I have to do something. So there was the guy was there who's kind of overseeing it, and I said, I've got to do something. And he said, here. And he handed me a 5-gallon bucket and a little plastic jug and a plastic cup. And he said, go give him something to drink. And I spent that afternoon wandering up and down these long lines of dying men, pouring water into dying people's throats. I mean, and they would look up at me with such gratitude. I didn't even know how to talk about it. I walked out of there, and I sat on the curb. There's a Kali temple behind it that just, you talk about paganism. But I sat on the curb thinking to myself, you know what? I went to the beach because of the tsunami. And I'm struggling with whether I should have stayed there. But the tsunami happened. It was a tragedy. It was a terrible disaster. But 25 years from now, it will be a terrible memory. This was true 200 years ago, 100 years ago, and barring Jesus' return, this will be true 100 years from now. And I would bet there's one of these in your town. There's a nursing home here where there are patients who are simply waiting to die and no one visits them. And if it's not in Twin Falls, you wouldn't have to drive far to find it. And what God taught me was, if I stand on the beach and get all worked up about a 15-year-old kid named Vedri, but can walk by this in my town, then I wasted my time. And so what I've decided to do, my wife and I, actually she decided and I wholeheartedly said, I will go with you. We're going to spend a day a week, part of a day a week, at the mission in Holland. And I'm going to minister to people who are in chaos. Because I want to be like Jesus. Now, I don't want to be held up as the model. Honestly, I did not come here to say be like me. I came here to say be like Jesus. But I think being like Jesus can be reduced to theological things.